So who all else was on the International Electronics
Oh.
Committee?
Most countries, it turns out, had a standards operation, and usually most of the other people that were on it, on the committee, were from a standards operation, like our National Bureau of Standards. And we did have someone from our National Bureau of Standards that was there, but he was not a very good technical person, and so he tried to get someone out of industry also to be a member of it each time. And so I served for the instruments. They did standards on many other things like lighting and all kinds of other things, but this one that I chaired for the U.S. delegation was for measurement instruments. So then, but Russia was in it, but they were still behind the Iron Curtain. So they sent not only they sent both a technical guy, and then he had someone with him who was not a technical guy, but was a part of the basically a part of the Russian Secret Service or whatever they use to keep track politically of what anyone from Russia who went to the Western anywhere to Western Europe keep track of. And my very good friend from Hungary, I made very good friends with, had the same thing. They watched the Hungarian came with him and watched him and made sure he didn't do anything he couldn't. But with him, I did manage one thing. I made very good friends with him, and I gave him an invitation that Hungary felt they couldn't turn down to come over and speak to the American Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, which sounds like a pretty relevant body, including the engineering people at Tektronix, of which they had a very high opinion in Russia, and because they'd gotten our scopes illegally. So Dr. Ferenczi, actually, in the long run, came over here and spoke to us, and he was a very good friend of mine, and had no use for the Russians and the Communist Party at all. He just, and they did not send any kind of a guard with him over here. But anytime we met in Europe, there would always be someone from the Russian KGB, I guess, in attendance.
So,
Don't know what
how did Russia get these oscilloscopes?
I visited my friend in Hungary, and his wife was a PhD engineer, double electronic engineer, and his wife was also a Dr. Ferenczi, and she was head of the television engineering in Hungary. So she had a pretty good job. And he was a professor in the University of Hungary. And he took me to his office in the university, and there was a Tektronix oscilloscope, and it was chained to his desk. I mean, chained and locked to his desk so that some other guy couldn't make off with it. And I said, "How in the world did you get that over there? We do not ship to any of, we don't Swiss to any of the communist countries." And he said, "Look at the serial numbers. The serial numbers have been completely erased, and there were stamps on it from practically every country in the world." I said, "How do you get them?" He said, "Well, I have a Tektronix catalog here. I order them out of a catalog just like you would. It takes me about 6 months to get it, and in the course of me getting it, it will have been shipped all around the world and finally come in here." So So, you know, it's kind of funny because all the barriers you put up and all the things you do, there's a way around it. There's always a way around it. So he had this beautiful telescope chained to his desk with all of the serial numbers erased off of it.
Were there times that stood out as more challenging while you were at Tektronix?
Oh, plenty of challenges. I think there were two very challenging times. One was back in the early 80s. When in the economic, worldwide economics were kind of on a downswing, and it came at a bad time, Tektronix. They actually were struggling just to break even there for a few years. That was not a very good time. Howard died during that time, became ill and died during that time, and so we were going through a change of presidents, and that was a bad period of time. And then we got one of the last president we got in was a Jerry Meyer, who really just was interested in pushing his stock options. As far as I'm concerned, his I don't care if it's on the record. You probably don't want to use it because he'd just make enemies or maybe get sued. But as far as I was concerned, and my conviction was, he was interested in his stock option. He was not very interested in making Tektronix a wonderful company, and was in fact the instrument, the guy that eventually sold the company to Danaher. Which was very good for him. It was good for me too, because I had a lot of Tektronix stock, and he got a good price for it. But we lost really the premier company, except for Intel, but the premier self-grown Oregon company. Well, I didn't like that. I didn't like it at all. And I couldn't get it stopped. By that time, our board was mostly made up of outside members. And that's what happens to companies. You start in, and to begin with, the board has people like Howard Vollenblom and people like me who came up through the ranks, and we all think alike and see alike. And then as time goes on, because people die and other things change, you eventually get more and more outsiders on the board, and eventually they don't have it. They really only are interested in shareholder return, and not interested in the company as an entity and how to make it a good company, a great place to work, good for the community, good for Oregon, which were values that all of us at Tektronix, from Howard and Jack on right on down, who were, as long as it was in their hands, were really very serious values. Howard, we had people who were on the planning committees. We tried to do things to help get stoplights where they needed to be and get roads where they needed to be, get a fire station over here where it needed to be, and our officers in our company get busy with the Beaverton government or the Washington County government or whatever it was and say, how do we get this thing done? And help make it happen. That eventually went away when most of our board members were outside members. And they didn't think about the board. Outside board members typically don't think much about the company until they're on the airplane coming to a board meeting, and then they say, what's going on in this company? So companies change when they go from the founders to having a preponderance of outsiders.
Mm-hmm. Were there any projects or committees that you were involved with here in Washington County that as a Tektronics employee, you were able to do some project for the community?
I really wasn't. I guess probably my interests were much more involved with the products and the technologies. And I really left most of that to other people who liked to do it and were better at it. And especially in the case of Tektronix, we had very good, from early on, a guy named Bill Weber had been sort of the community and world at large interface. If you came to Tektronix, you talked to Bill Weber. He was vice president. He had been there a long, long time. He was very close to Howard and all of us who were vice presidents, and a very trustworthy guy. And he would deal with a lot of this kind of thing. And we who were dealing with the operating piece didn't have to deal with that so much. But the attitude from the top down was always be good community citizens, help where you can, help with anything from traffic problems to tax issues or whatever are coming up. Try to be helpful in solving them, and equitable and fair, and leave people feeling that everybody has done a good job on it. And Tech participated heavily in community activity during all the years that I was active there. Both Jack and Howard, and I would just say, I mean, Jack Murdoch and Howard Bottom, I would just say this, just kind of stick it in, because Howard is kind of a known quantity because he was president and chief owner for so long, but Murdoch had a heavy influence in the character of the company. He was a gentleman and a gentleman, and not particularly a technical person, although he came from some technical background and loved technology. But he really thought a lot about organizations and how to make them work. And he was very tempted to make Tektronix into an entirely employee-owned company. But he understood and had done enough research to know that some of those attempts had really gone bad. It didn't work that well, because a company needs to be investing always for long range and ahead of time and getting ready. And if it's company owned, the people who are there are more interested in short-term benefits than they are in long-term corporate growth. And by and large, the old General Radio was often used an example that it doesn't really work out to be a good way to do it. So they went a different way and said, we'll make very heavily a profit-sharing company. So as I came to work for Tektronix, if you took the Tektronix profits, it was basically divided three ways. About a third of our profits went to pay taxes, and about a third of our profits went to the employees in profit share, and about a third of our profits went back into the company to grow the company and engineer the next rounds of products and so forth, keep the company growing. So we were a very very equality-oriented kind of company. We wanted to be fair with the employees, and we wanted them to feel like this was their company, and they really had that part. So we had not a union, but we had a very strong, area rep system, so that every area, every month, got to, I think I mentioned this, got to get the managers up in front of them and tell them what was wrong and what they thought ought to be changed and why, and get, force them to a feedback to deal with these issues. So it had that character to it. Everything was open, the cash boxes were open, the doors were unlocked at all hours when there was anything at all going on around there. There were no fences around the yards. There still are no fences around the Tektronik property. That was a beautiful property there. You can drive right out through the middle of it and all around it, and where the buildings are, there's no fences. An open company is open as a society would allow it to be, and still is kept that way. I rather like the Danaher people. I think it's a big conglomerate, but from everything I see, they are doing a nice job in today's world of running the company and keeping the property nice. Employees who work there seem to feel are treated fairly. Don't feel too bad about it all. I'd rather it was still an Oregon-owned company.
What ways do you think the county has supported the high-tech industry or encouraged its growth here?
Well, I haven't personally involved myself in that to be the best spokesman for how that was done. But I will say that it has seemed to me there was always good, there's always been good relationships, and that if there were a stoplight needed somewhere that had to do with our traffic or whatever, that we were in and offering to pay for half of it or doing whatever seemed to be the thing that was needed to be done and cooperate with it. We kept all of our own roads inside of the area ourselves, and we blocked them one day a year so that they could not become public roads. But yet the public used them, and that was okay for us. We just wanted to keep the option of being able to keep them like we wanted and take care of them and run them where we wanted and so forth, although they got used. We built the fire. We gave them grounds to build a fire station nearby for that big trailer park and neighborhood. I think we had, as near as I could tell, we had really good personal relations. We had Tom Williams and Bill. I'll just say his name anyway. We had the guys that interfaced the community. Were really well thought of people, and I think did a good job for Tektronix on community relations. Bill Weber.
When do you first remember hearing the term Silicon Forest?
Yeah.
Or if not, you know, what does it mean to you?
Yeah, I think I first heard the term. Who were the guys? Was it Sequent? Do you know who generated the term?
I don't.
I thought maybe you did. Mm-hmm. Well, I did know who generated the term. It was one of these. What seemed to me like newer companies, but not. Seems to me like it may have been Sequent. I wonder if Lou remembers that. Let me ask you.
I don't know.
It did.
So it was originally referred to as the Silicon Rainforest?
Yeah, I think she's right. That's the first words we heard on it were Silicon Rainforest.
Yes. Yes.
And what does that mean to you when you hear that term?
Well, silicon, you know what silicon is. It's the substance that all of the active components in electronic equipment is made of. And so it's the substance that all of the Intel, literally all of the Intel products are made out of silicon, and all of the Tektronix products are made with silicon pieces made by Intel or Sequel or other companies out of silicon. So silicon is the primary building block for high-tech equipment. So it's all the high-tech equipment coming through here, I get generated that term silicon rainforest. And we became, I think, a good place for a number of the California companies to try to come up and use our labor market and our, and that.
Can I give you a little bit more?
Labor market came to pass because Tektronix trained their engineers, and we were the source of a lot of that labor market early on. And creative engineers wanted to go out and get involved with new companies and new startups. Many of them got wealthy, became multimillionaires in the process, just like the guys at Planar, that started Planar.
And being so isolated originally out here, how do you think that contributed to the success of the companies, or made it difficult for them perhaps at the beginning?
Well, for Tektronix, it had a very definite effect. Because we were isolated, we tended to not only build the final product, which was the oscilloscope, but we don't have other suppliers readily available that we can get this made and this made and this made and this made. So we've started our own components business. Even the cathode ray tube, which is the thing you look at, you know, we even built our own cathode ray tube plant really very early so that we could build it like we want, influence it like we want. Otherwise, we would have had to have bought cathode ray tubes from somewhere in the Northeast, and we'd had taken their technology and what they had done, and it just, the guys who really were pushing the state of the art, like Howard Vollum and Jack Murdoch were, you just couldn't do that. You had to have an influence on the components. And so because we were here and not up in the Northeast or even down in the Bay Area, which was ahead of us, we built up our own components industry. We built almost all of our components. We built resistors and switches and the cathode ray tube and integrated circuits. We literally built it from the ground up. We built our own wiring, our own cables. We take the wires and stripe them ourselves and build our own cables. Everything. So it made us very self-sufficient, but the real thing I think you're digging at is, because we were doing those things, we built up little capabilities all around here to supply us with them. And we didn't really want that to be our main business, and so if one would get big enough, we would let them spin off and do their own thing and cut their costs by distributing to a larger customer base than just Tektronix alone, and let them be their own company. So that really did a huge amount to build us. So, I mean, there was a time until Intel came in, almost everything, almost every electronic company in Oregon was a spin-out from Tektronix in some form.
And HP?
Well, HP didn't come to Oregon until fairly late, and they came to Corvallis. And they didn't get any spin-outs, hardly. They were always our main, always Tektronix's primary competitor. It was always Hewlett-Packard.
And so you were involved with Planar which was one of the spin-offs.
Yeah.
And ESI as well.
They're not exactly one of the spin-offs. Let me give you a little bit of background of ESI. ESI came about like this. And here's kind of the connection. There was a company in Portland called Brown
Bridge
Company, the Brown Bridge Company, and they built a very simple instrument that was called a bridge that you could use to take two quantities and kind of compare them with each other. And they also built some standards, which were secondary standards, which were based on the National Bureau of Standards in Washington, D.C. And anyone in the electrical or electronic business could then test against their standard without having to go all the way back to Washington, D.C. So it was this little company that had a few standards, very simple instruments, and a bridge. And and Brown decided that he wanted to move to Seattle and take the business to Seattle. But he said, I don't really want to take the standards. That's not a very good business. I'm just going to take the bridge part of the business. And so, what's his name? But
Doug Strain.
Yeah, Doug Strain at ESI, who founded ESI, said to Brown, I don't want to go to Seattle, so could I buy from you the part of the business that makes the standards? And Brown said, well, yeah. So they made a deal on selling Doug Strain the standards. Doug didn't have any money to buy it with, so he stopped by Howard Bollum's house on his way home that night and said, Howard, will you loan me the money to buy this product and this little company, or to split this little company off when Brown moves to Seattle? And so Howard said, yeah, I'll loan you the money. So Howard Bollum loaned Doug Strain the money to buy that, and then so Doug Strain went out, and the Tektronix Retirement Trust, which is held the funds for the retirement plan, also held some of had invested some of them in land around here, and some of the land they'd invested in was over by Sunset Highway, and so they let Doug Strain build the first ESI plant on the Tektronix Trust property, and that's where the ESI plant still is. So anyway, there's that kind of a relationship went on, and so ESI always felt a little like a cousin of Tektronix to us. So when Paul Littner died with a heart attack running on a beach, he was CEO there. I was on their board, and I agreed to come on until we could find a new CEO, and I actually stayed on 3 years as CEO before I left. And it's kind of interesting because ESI plugs along over there. A lot of most companies have been bought up and in some kind of a conglomerate, even Tektronix, but ESI still plugs along. I don't know. I think one of these days someone is going to come along and buy them. And I don't know what has kept it from happening, but it's kind of nice. They're still their own little private company over there. They've never become too big. But they do okay.
Did you have any particular mentors within the businesses, or did you mentor people in Planar and in ESI?
Well, I would say that Howard Bollum was probably my mentor. He and I pretty early on. Well, for one thing, they had a little thing they called Key Employee Program that I was. That they had done a round or two before, and then after I came, It was something where he and Murdoch, Jack Murdoch, who owned stock, would sell some of their personal stock to someone that people that they had decided were key employees in the company. They were going to be key employees to make this company better and great. And so I was in the last round of that, and Howard was the one that sold me some of his personal stock in Tektronix. This was long before they were public, so it was just private stock. He didn't give it to me. It was risk. I had to risk it because it was on a ten year payout plan. I did a 5% per year for 10 years, and then the rest of it was due at the end 10 years as a lump payment. So I borrowed money to do that, to buy stock in Tektronix during all that time. And of course, I talked to Howard a little early on about that, and then later on, he came to be someone I really could work with, and I like to start new things, and he liked that. He loved it, and so he and I really became two that together could do a lot of stuff. And I thought so much of him. He was such an honest guy and very, very creative, very innovative, very creative. He was a great photographer, a pretty good artist on top of that, loved good music. But on anything, he was kind of like a Steve Jobs. If he picked that up, and before he walked out of the room, he would have something laid out differently on that and added to it. He just was a very creative guy. It was fun to even go to watch him around when he was having his car lubricated or something. He's always talking to him about what ought to be done different. Very creative guy, and I liked him a lot. Very honest, totally creative, a nice sense of humor. Not a hard-nosed about anything, but just a really wonderful guy to work for. And so we did form a tight relationship that in some ways would, when I really wanted to do something, in some ways would bypass all of the intervening layers that big companies get laid up. Good ace in the hole for me. But he loved it because I would get out and do things like start the IC operation, and something that was bring a whole kind of, he was creative enough that you bring a whole new element into how to build oscilloscopes, and he really liked all that, and we got along good. And he married to a wonderful woman. They had 6 boys.
And that's a lot of boys.
One of them died, but they raised the other 5. But none of them ever came into the business. Jean was a really fine gal, and she came on the tech board after Howard was gone, and she and I managed to collaborate and hold the fort on a lot of things for a long time.
Yourself and Mr. Vollum and Mr. Murdoch all seem to have been so involved in the management and the growth of these companies, in Tektronix in particular. How did you all manage the balance between work life and life outside of work, or was that a blurred line?
What life? No, we did that. I think we all did that really pretty well, and Tektronix really allowed it pretty well. It had a family orientation, And you know, we had family picnics, and families were welcome on the premises, and they would come in, could get in and out the doors, and to see their husbands if they needed. Wouldn't you say that it was quite opening in that respect?
I never did that.
You never did it, no. But people
I took
did.
Some
and
of
could.
The they would allow people to take the classes, and they had big picnics each year. That all the family came.
What kind of classes did you take?
Well, I just found a certificate Bill did earlier that it was a class on international relations.
That you had
no,
taken?
No,
no,
interpersonal, interpersonal relations.
Interpersonal
yeah,
relations?
Interpersonal relations. I just ran across it in the garage. I was looking
I just
through some
got
old
a certificate.
Weeks.
And then I took one on, two or three.
Did you and I take the Myers-Briggs together?
No, we did that later at ESI.
At ESI? I took a course in flying.
And I took that too.
Yeah, you did.
Ground
That's right,
school.
You did. You took ground school.
But one we took was from a Portland State professor, and it was on...
Oh, Richens.
Yeah, on psychology, so mostly psychological things.
And who was the Arkansas-er that gave, really liked it, did some courses for us? I don't know. Anyway... it was really open. The doorway was just open. She could walk in or out or...
I could have, but I didn't think it was the proper thing to do.
No, you didn't, but some people did. And,
But board meetings, wives and family always went to an annual shareholders meeting. They would all show up and sit together, which is not done today. No longer done, but I would sit by Edna Wantlund or the other wives at the
Virginia
annual
Polish
shareholders
or
meetings.
Yeah.
And we would.
Yeah, our annual shareholders meeting were always just open, real open things, and then encouraged all of the employees to come that wanted to. And here the board, any one of the board members could ask questions to any one of the board members or any of the management people at that. And John Addis, who still is part of the there is a tech retiree website that we interact on, and John Addis is always in there agitating for something, and he would stand up at nearly every one of them and give a long spiel on what was wrong with Tektronix. And
what kind of things would he spiel about?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. It would be anything from why there's not coffee out for some shift in Building 50 when there was coffee out for shifts and all those shifts in another building. Or, can you remember any of the things that he made speeches about?
Be something very political, like... how you were treating employees somewhere else in some other country or not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was often something sort of political.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did Tektronix try to extend their corporate atmosphere or community atmosphere to their international hubs or did they?
Well, they did, and they had to do it within the norms of that particular entity, which may be very different. It was easy to do in Australia, for instance, because they're kind of down home, a little bit more down home. It was harder to do in some of the Central European countries like France or Germany, where they're more used to a formal atmosphere and the boss treated formally and spoken to formally first names not used and so forth. So we tried to introduce all of those things, and we succeeded in really in every country to make a significant impact in the direction of informality rather than formality. But you always were a little bit bounded by just the national habits and what was good manners there. We did succeed pretty broadly in getting people onto a first name basis, though. And we did succeed pretty broadly in reducing the office space so that the higher up you were, you didn't have the bigger office and et cetera, et cetera. We managed to create a lot more equality among the employees. Howard loved to say, we are all equal. I just have a different job than you do. But there's no difference in our equality. You can talk to me like I can talk to you, like you can talk to other employees. We'll do it on a first name basis and a friendly basis and a business basis, and it's not a matter of status. We just have different jobs.
Never any parking spaces for anybody. Have you already told her that?
No.
Nobody ever had a parking space. Howard parked in the rain on the backside because he was usually there later. Bill did too. He drove a little old blue car.
Yeah, see Howard walking in the morning through the rain. He owned this company, but he walked in the back of the parking lot because he got there later than some of the other employees.
There were
no special parking places
for anybody.
And he just followed that pattern all the way through in everything. From dining rooms to cash boxes to we even kept our stock room open. Now this is a company filled with technical people, engineers and all these kind of things, and the stock room was open, and some of the guys from the finance group said, you know, Howard, you know, people are going to steal stuff out of that stock room. And Howard said, well, if they take some of it to build their own audio equipment, they'll probably learn just as much in that process as if we paid to send them off to school to learn and educate them. And if they want to do that, it's not going to cost us very much. Such a smart attitude. And it didn't cost us anything. And if I wanted to build another piece of audio equipment and go in there and get parts out of the stock room to build audio equipment, that was fair game. And he did that with all the engineering, well, not only engineers, anybody could do that. Now, if we decided we're going to build if a whole bunch of them got together and going to build a whole big group of something like a transistor stereo amplifier, then we would make a deal with a supply room and say, okay, we're going to get so many and so many and so many and so many of all these, and they would just give it to you at whatever it cost them. But if you just wanted a few of something or the other, just went in and got it.
Did you ever bring parts or equipment home to tinker with or to use here?
Oh yeah, if I wanted any piece of test equipment to make some test here, I just bring it home and use it and take it back.
What would you be testing?
Oh, if you're an engineer, you're always curious about something. Maybe I'm just sticking it in the wall plug here to see if there's any radio being signals coming out of what should be just 60 cycle, which just goes like this, nice and smooth. If there's stuff riding on it, and saying to myself, maybe that's what's causing some of the interference in one of our radios or some interference on a TV set or something. Yeah, I'd go troubleshoot my own electronics around here and use tech instruments.
Did you share that with your children at all?
Yeah, none of them. I only had a daughter and a son, and he ended up getting a degree in computer science, but he wasn't. He's more involved in basic electronics now than he ever has been before, because he's gotten really wrapped up in audio systems and how to get the maximum fidelity with all the harmonics in a good audio system. So he's learning more electronics right now than he ever learned before. But he was more of a computer person than electronics. But he always knew that I had these instruments and he could play with them or do what he needed to do with them. But he didn't have much interest in that until he got a little older.
Would you have any advice for a young person looking into the high-tech industry?
Yes, I think my advice would be to look at the startups that were going on around them, the small startups, and what they were doing and which things interested you. And the second thing, if you can find a way, either first-hand or second-hand, first-hand hopefully, to find out what the management of that thing are like. What are they like? Are they real people that you can sit and talk to and honest and just you feel good about? Because if you go to work for something, you need to go to work for something that you really can take an interest in. Because you'll do, if you're interested in it, you almost certainly are going to do pretty well. If you're not really interested in it, it's just a job. And it's also important that you establish personal relationships. Those personal relationships are worth so much. I was both mentored by Howard Ballam, and I mentored people in my church and kids. A guy I consider an absolutely world-class engineer. Well, he used to be in my Sunday school class in church, and after class, at that time he was in high school and trying to repair audiovisual equipment for his high school. That was a kind of a part-time job he had. So we would be up on the blackboard drawing diagrams, and I would be feeding him all the information I could to make him a good technician. He's an absolutely world-class engineer now. He did some of the basic stuff for planar systems in terms of addressing how to address a flat panel for both sides, and he has several patents around that. And when he He's missionary, works mostly, his wife's a missionary, and he's off in the boondocks most of the time, but every time he comes back, Planar has him in for whatever few days or weeks he's here. Tim, come help us. We're having a dressing problem, we're having this problem, whatever, and he can go in with his background in their display system, so he can go in and give him some help. Yeah. And I love to have someone like that to mentor. It's great. It's great. It was great fun. I mentored him all the way through college. I told him what little calculators and computers to buy and not buy. And then when he came to work for Tektronix, and he got an offer from Planar, and he'd come and say, "Should I take it?" And I said, "What are they offering?" And he'd say, "Well, this and some, there's so many stock options." I'd say, "Take the stock options and go to work for them." And he'd come maybe 6 months or a year later, he'd say, "Tektronix offered me some more stock options to come back. What should I do?" "Go back, take the stock options. If they want you, that's what you should do." So he did that, and he went back and forth between Planar and Tech, and they both wanted him because he was such a valuable, creative guy, and he'd get stock options each time he would move. Yeah, I like to mentor these. You don't find people as gifted as he was that often, but every now and then you do, and it's nice.
Paul Dubose,
another one. It's nice when you do that. You run into, you're able to give them some help and some good advice along the way.
So his name was Tim?
Tim Flegel. Mm-hmm. F-L-E-A-G-A-L-E.
G-A-L.
G-A-L, yeah, F-L-E-A-G-A-L.
And there was another person, Paul?
Paul Dubose, D-U-B-O-S-E. Mm-hmm. Well, there's others, but those are two that we think of special.
He has, I don't know how many doctor's degrees.
Yeah, Paul has gone on and... kinds of wonderful technical stuff. He tended more toward the mathematical side. And
there were others all through the years.
It's okay.
You can.
I appreciate it. You can.
She's legitimate. You can help. She's a legitimate commentator. She's lived through all of this. Night and day, and me coming home in a bad humor, and how bad it had been all day, and how dumb my boss was. And I think I'm going to be fired next week for some fight I'm in.
What he used to do is come home and say, "Well, I have another promotion, and I don't know if I can make it or not, because those people here in that level and all the people are really smart and really bright, and I just don't know if I can handle this level or not," he'd say. But he really thought he could, I think. Else he wouldn't have taken it. But it was a fun thing.
All our life's been fun.
Did you ask about our family?
I haven't asked too much about it, but is there something you want to share?
Well, he did tell you about our son. Mm-hmm. He worked at Tektronix for several years writing technical manuals, but he didn't tell them. You know, Walker's a common name, and he went over there and got a job without telling them who he was. And then some of the people eventually nosed it out and found out that he was the son of a vice president of the company at that time, probably. But our daughter is the one who loves computers and has a degree in English literature, but she is really good with computers. And she takes classes all the time. And she has taken so many classes everywhere, Washington, D.C., Salt Lake City, she just got back from, that she's a certified genealogist. And once in a while, she'll take a client. She helps her husband run a business along with their kids, but she'll take a client. Right now, she's working with one out of New York that wants to trace his family heritage. We're proud of them.
Yeah. How do you think your husband influenced your children's decisions to go into that work, or do you think he has?
Well, he's a writer, and they're both writers, very good writers. And he taught them to read before they went to school. And so they're just both avid readers. So, and as we both are, so I think together we...
They're both really good writers. I'm really proud of their writing skills.
I'm not a writer, but...
No, but you're a reader and...
Yeah.
Very... up, but both of them are writers. Scott's just about to finish up a science fiction book that he's done, and
that he hopes to publish.
Janice is just about to finish up a poetry book that I did and get it published.
And the state of South Carolina asked her, as a part of her genealogy stuff, to write how to do genealogy in the state of South Carolina.
That's one of her books. That's the official book in South Carolina.
Goes in the National Historical Library. And we have a grandson who's a freshman in electrical engineering at Oregon State, and he just called and said he made 95 on his electrical engineering class. So.
I was a reasonable engineer, reasonably good engineer, but I really, my talent really had to do with creating organization and systems within an organization. You know, isn't just the organization, it's the system. Do you have the systems? How do they communicate? How do they, what do they communicate? How do they work together? And how do you organize to make all that happen? I pushed them into a divisionalized system because as an oscilloscope company, it was okay to be just one monolithic company, but as we got into television products and computer display products and so as several different kinds of product lines, we really needed division, so I pushed them into divisionalized structure. So organization, my honest contribution to Tektronix were not directly to technology. It was the organizational structure, and it was even going out and getting ourselves into an integrated circuit capability and those kind of things, which would allow us to have the bits and pieces that would go together to make the instrument. As far as sitting down and laying out wiring diagrams to make a thing like that, there are engineers 100 times better than I am at doing that. I mean, they just are amazing. I love those engineers that can do that. They're just amazing. You know, the Steve Jobs type people.
Is there anything else that that either of you think is important to include for the exhibit?
Anything else that we ought to think about for the exhibit?
I don't know, Bill.
I don't either.
I don't know what you can put in as an exhibit that he's told you or I've told you.
Let's see, what did I bring up here? I brought up some things. I think one of them, oh, that was the ESI, my ESI time. I thought I brought up something else.
We can look more into that stuff in a moment, too. I can...
There I was when I came.
It looks like the style of today for the kids.
It does, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. So, why do you think that the Silicon Forest developed here in Washington County, of all places?
Well, I don't know where Howard's wife, Jean, lived, and I don't really know where Howard's original home was. They developed the home together and raised their family up on Skyline Boulevard. But I have heard them, I've heard Jean say, talk about and point out to me where the first Tektronix building was built on along Sunset Highway. That she and Howard, when they were courting, would come and sit out there in the apple orchard and talk about they were going to get a, build a building there. And Howard and Jack, who had a little their little business started downtown on Hawthorne Boulevard, I think at that time, and they were going to build a building out there and move out there. And she and Howard were going to marry and live somewhere over on the west side. So that's how Gene and Howard how Gene and Howard came to be on the west side. He called her Kit. She went by the nickname of Kit. And she was a Canadian. And a powerful lady in her own right, and a very good board member at Tektronix. And I'm sure a strong partner in raising those six boys. Well, Howard built a company.
Okay.
What have I missed, Lou? What have we not talked about that we should talk about?
I don't know. Just that Tektronix being here led to the rest of it. The spin, the Tektronix was the first, and it just...
And
I've seen, I'm sure you've seen those charts that they do, and you can see how Tektronix was the center of that.
At our peak, we were 20,000 people in Tektronix alone, and I wonder if we really traced it back right now and looked at all the spin-outs that came from Tektronix. I wonder what the total employment in Oregon is for the spin-outs, and I don't know the answer to that. It might not be easy even to get it, but some of them spun out as companies, some of them just were individuals that went off and later on came back and started companies.
One of them was a furniture company for computers and
for
electronic equipment.
Lab equipment. Mm-hmm. And it's still a very prosperous company. I'm trying to think of its name.
It's interesting. Were there other companies that started up in Washington County, not necessarily in the technology field, but like you said, supportive type industries?
This is one, at least. What others? I'd have to think about that a while. I'm sure there have been a couple of others.
I'm sure there's. But once you have 20,000 people, well, they weren't all here in Beaverton, but 12,000 at least were.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And once you have all those people, you have to have an infrastructure. So that means the car dealerships and the restaurants and the grocery stores and the, all the service people that surround that many the schools. You can just see how that would happen.
Tech always gave scholarships to the three high schools in Washington County, Beaverton, Hillsboro, and Aloha.
To young people who they interviewed, and then they would give full to partial scholarships to those going into technical fields. Mm-hmm. And you could name a lot of them whose careers you followed. He was on that board too for many, many years, the Tech Scholarship Board with Gene and Howard and
Bill Weber and Gene and Howard and I.
Gene, and that's all I can remember.
That's pretty much it. Oh, we always had an outside board member on, like Paul Bragdon or whoever. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are there any other people that you think would be good for the museum to contact to learn more about
Silicon
Forest?
We've mentioned Kobe already. Mm-hmm. You already had him on your list.
Yep.
Boy, he can talk about the very early part. I think he won't talk about it, but he and Howard didn't really come into conflict, I would say. But they didn't mesh well as they should. Both of them, creative geniuses. Howard was interested in the looks to a greater degree than John was, and John was interested in function, almost to the exclusion of the other. And so you can see how they didn't always have the same priority, but they each made huge contributions, but their two personalities didn't quite gel, which is really too bad. I wish they could have. I really wish they could have, because it kept Kobe from staying at Tektronix as long as he should have stayed and continuing to do the things that he could do.
What about Pat Kunkel to get a woman? Do you have any women? You have her?
That is something that our class has spoken about often, is that we do not have any women yet as interviewers. And so what was her name again?
Pat Kunkel.
K-U-N-K-L-E. She became a vice president of the company.
First woman.
The first
vice
woman.
President of,
yeah.
The company.
Of Tech?
Tech.
Yes, at Tektronix. And then there was a woman who was head of...
I really would like for you to, because she grew up and eventually ran the human resources personnel kind of thing for them. So she has an in-depth understanding of the culture and the things that made the culture work and the systems that were the subsystems that made it work. She'd be an excellent person for you to contact.
You have her email or phone number or address.
I have it somewhere. She spends part of her time in...
But she's here now.
Redmond. Is she... By here, is she in town or...
Or in Bend area.
She's in Bend area.
She decided...
She's here for the winter instead of spending it in...
Well, I don't know. Ida would know.
Ida would know, yeah.
I don't know if Ida would be another person.
Yes, she might be.
Meyer was there for many, many years.
She was the HR person.
Ida Meyer?
And she knew everybody.
Yeah.
She could tell you lots of stories about Jim Castles, who was the attorney for Tektronix.
He helped put the Jim Castles wrote the organist He was a lawyer, and he wrote the organization papers when Tech organized. And they gave him a big chunk of stock in the company, new little company he was for having done that, which was a nice thing for him. It came to be worth multi-millions of dollars. But yeah, that's a very good point, Lou, that both Ida and Pat are
long-time people who knew everybody.
Knew everything and everybody.
And what was Ida's role in Tektronix?
She was in human resources as well. I think after Pat left and had a more corporate job, then Ida was the head of that, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was the head of one section of it. I don't know if she was the head of
all
of it or not.
I don't know exactly. But she could tell you, you know, she'd be happy to. They're in Palm Springs right now, but they'll be back this week. And we do have their phone number and
I wonder if Pat's
email.
I bet Pat's. I wonder where they are.
I don't know.
Well, any information, like contact information and stuff like that, maybe we could get afterwards. And
I'll see if I
can be in contact.
Yeah, you can check with Ida, but I'll see if I can contact Pat.
Okay.
All right, well, if there's anything else, or not anything else right now, we can also stay in contact, and if there's stuff that comes up later on,
If things cross my mind, I'll jot them down and either send you something or if it's something we need to talk about longer, while we can maybe get together and have a cup of coffee or come back by here, whatever works for you.
Sure, yeah. Well, thank you very much. That'll conclude the recording for Tuesday the 21st.
Friend.
Oh, Frankie.
You don't want her interview.
Oh, you don't want Frankie. No, Frankie Butts. I don't know what her name is now. She's remarried. I'll tell you, first time I saw her, guy who just worked with me, I hadn't had a manager job too long, but this guy that just worked for me had hired him for a secretary. Glenn Pelican had hired her for a secretary. And the guy that had hired me, who to me was like God, he was way up here somewhere and he ran the whole manufacturing organization. He came to see me and I went into Glenn Pelican's office to introduce him to Glenn Pelican. And there sat this secretary in the big chair with her feet up on the desk like this, smoking a cigar. That was Hattie, that was Frankie Butte or Butts or whatever. And she was a flamboyant buxom blonde. Earl Scott was like, what was that?
She was
Cracker Jack secretary. She was fast as lightning. She took care of everything. She was a very good secretary. She was flamboyant.
But today, those people don't exist. They changed to computers, and everybody does all their own work. And
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But back then, a secretary did it and took notes and...
I'm glad I was working back then. That was a much
better
system.
Didn't have to make your own reservations or airlines or...
I think
it's a waste of time. I really think these secretaries, men or women, are so good at certain things and should have honor and recognition for it. But I think, in whether it's a man or a woman, if they spend too much time at this routine stuff, instead...
Which
you're not very good at. So I just anyhow, I'm not sure the world's better today for it.
Yeah. Without having the secretaries, the administrative assistants around.
Yes, yeah. They're all called administrative assistants now, I think.
Yeah.
Aren't they? I suppose mm-hmm. there's some secretaries, but I know before Bill retired, his secretary had switched to administrative assistant, doing similar things.
Are there other women that you remember from Tech? I know you mentioned that you would sit with other wives at the board meeting, but were the wives or other women in the company that you recall?
Well, I'm trying to...
As interesting characters, or...
Think. You know, so many people have died who were our contemporaries, and so many of the women have. I'm trying to think of friends that we had made of those vice president's wives and corporate wives that I enjoyed, but they're not around. They're gone mostly.
What kind of influence did you have, or did other wives have, do you think, in the company?
What kind of what?
Influence.
Influence.
Mm.
Oh, you know, I think the wives of Tektronix were so careful. So if our husbands would have a, if you knew they were having a knocking heads, knock down, drag out, fight over something, you would go sit by that person and be courteous and friendly, and that was the atmosphere there. So I don't know influence that other wives had, basically. I just know I listened a lot to Bill, and I never knew anything. I was in a club with...
You mean you pretended to never know?
I pretended to never know anything. There were other wives in some of the places where I went, or groups, you know, that were community groups. And as far as they knew, Bill never told me anything, because I never said a word about anything. And I think that's the way most of them were. So I'm sure they influenced their husbands or listened, or... But as far as overt, it just never happened in those days. Interesting. I think our world has changed. And it may be because women are more out there. The wives back in those days did not work. We stayed home, took care of the children, did volunteer work, and traveled with their husbands when they traveled.
Went to dinners with us when it was... Went to dinners with us when it was appropriate.
Went to dinners or entertained. It was a different world, wasn't it?
Quite a bit.
It was a good world. But as far as she asked me how much influence the wives had, I don't know.
On business.
I don't know that it was... I'm sure that it was a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Just with their husbands, but as far as overt anywhere, none.
Yeah.
It just wasn't talked about.
I'm sure that they would go home from dinner meeting and say, "I don't like that guy for this reason and this reason, and you better watch him because he's..." Didn't they?
Possibility. Possibility.
I would say so.
Did I do that a time or two?
Oh, yeah.
I guess I had that kind of...
Because you also knew who in that group of my peers that I was kind of on the same wavelength with, and who was really opposing and fight, you know, and I had major conflict going on with. You did know there was major conflict going on, didn't you? And I didn't win every battle, but I won most of them. Yeah, I had a good time at it, to tell you the truth. It was great fun. Just what I love to do. How lucky can you get? I worked all my life, and as far as I was concerned, work is only work if you don't like it, and I had fun every single day, nearly every single day at work.
Bill used to make talks like that for classes like at OSU or Portland State or somewhere. And I know one time he was making a talk to a bunch of engineers at OSU. And one of the questions was, how many hours do you think you have to work to be successful in a job like yours? And he said to them, that's the wrong question. The question should be, how many hours do I get to work in order to do what I'm doing? Because it's fun and you like it. And
there's always more to do.
And there's always more to do. Didn't you? Now, I'm not saying he worked day and night, because he didn't. He gave plenty of attention to our children and to me. And one thing that he did that a lot of them didn't do, he always took weekends off unless he was on a trip somewhere. But if he was at home, then the weekend was at home with his family, and Sundays especially. Mm-hmm. And evenings. He didn't bring stacks of work home in the evenings. He brought stacks of reading, like magazines and electronic stuff. But you never brought home work. Gave the attention to the children and to me. So I think he would say that was the key to a good career. Was that you ask about that kind of balance?
Yeah.
Was his balance was his family and his church and what he could contribute there and teach teenagers, and then as much time as he could manage to get to work.
Went through a spell where flying was a passion I spent a lot of time at.
Yeah.
Did the two of you do many activities together with other fellow colleagues or
not a employees? Lot?
Tech was not a heavily social club.
Mm-mm.
No, we did not do a lot of things at each other's homes. We each had our own private lives, pretty much, and we might do something at Christmas or Thanksgiving or have a group out or something like that, or someone else might, but very little of that went on.
It was mostly business-related when we would have a dinner.
It was kind of nice that way, because there was not a pressure on wives to entertain or anything like that.
And they all had families, and they all had schools that they participated in with their children or supported and had their passions and interests. So we were not socially just daily or call each other up or anything like that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Some companies I know are much more tightly coupled socially than we ever were.
But Tektronix was never really like that. And, you know, they all had kids that had ball games, and our kids were involved in tennis, and Janice is always involved in theater and music, and so we were always there when that was going on.
Yeah. And I really support that as an ethic. I think family is first, because that's the place you have the most influence. It's the place you have the most pain if it goes bad. And you even worse than the pain of your job going bad is the pain of your family going bad. So that has to take the precedence over work.
With your children, it really does. And your marriage. And most of the families that we knew all through those years were like that. They,
Where are you in Portland, in school?
I'm in my last term.
Are you? Mm-hmm. Last term, boy.
The end of March. Oh. I'll be all done.
Oh, then what? You got a plan?
A little. Huh? A little. Do some archaeology. Stay around the Northwest.
Yeah. Yeah. That should be fun.
Mm-hmm.
And the marriages, my observation has been that on that level, that the marriages are usually solid marriages too, long-term marriages.
That Tektronix, that level of Tektronix, that's very true. There are almost no...
And that level, that level, you mean the more administrative?
Yeah, the level? Sort of the hot top couple or three levels in the company were all very strong families,
And solid marriages,
yeah.
Long term marriages. With the, of course, there was the exception now and then. But they didn't last long. I don't know if it was the culture or the what do you think it was?
I don't know. Well, I don't know. I was trying to think of you probably know more of the knew more of the inside stories of those kind of things than I did with Alfie. Alfie's was a second marriage, wasn't it?
Maybe, but Diane was always the one that was with him here.
Yeah.
And they always had two small children. So.
Yeah.
I never knew anything else.
It's true, all the upper management seemed to have strong marriages.
And it's either... you don't know whether it's the chicken or the egg. You know, yeah, really don't.
So where would you like to dig?
Well, I don't know if there's...
On the coast.